Sanders in the Senate. He's been the role he's playing right now in forcing, hopefully, the Senate to take up the issue of $2,000 help.
Would you endorse this filibuster today?
Yes, I think I would. You know, the point is that there will eventually, the Senate will have to deal with it. And I think the refusal of McConnell to have democratic processes work, let people go on the record of what their view on this $2,000 seems to be part of the democratic process. There shouldn't be that much power in the majority leader in the Senate.
Joe Stiglitz, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Nobel Prize winning economist, Columbia University professor, chief economist for the Roosevelt Institute. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. Wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Tuesday. Time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. You're listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor. This is our last broadcast of 2020. Tracy Simmons, my illustrious co-host, how are you doing?
You know, I am doing okay. I am freezing cold because it's, you know, I don't know, probably 30-something degrees right now in Portland. But, you know, I'm just really in a weird place. You know, last show we talked about this $600 stimulus, and then for a few days it felt like we weren't going to get a darn thing. And now we see there's some movement. Trump finally got himself off the golf course and signed the stimulus package. And at the same time, we know that the House has passed a resolution to increase that $600 one-time payment to $2,000 one-time payment, and it has to go to the Senate. And we'll see if that gets signed by Trump again, if it all goes through. But one senator, and a Republican, I'm sure, could, you know, send that to the flames. So who knows? I'm just in this really weird headspace, trying to really step into a space of gratitude and hope for 2021, and just so excited to say goodbye to 2020. It has been one really funky year.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I think I'm feeling similarly to that. It's, you know, we have every reason right now to look forward with optimism. well, perhaps not every reason, but sufficient reasons to look forward with optimism. Yet it's hard to get there when when the year closes out the way it did, and when it was the way it was. You talked about how Trump dithered for a while before he finally signed the Omnibus Spending Act that contained the COVID relief. Yes, he did finally sign it. He did finally deliver unto Americans the $600 that will, of course, you know, bridge them to prosperity. But he did so too late, and meant that millions of people missed a week of unemployment benefit because he was having a fit of pique. And really, if you're looking for perhaps a single episode to summarize, it's not Trump's presidency than the man himself. Look no further.
Yeah, I mean, what's so interesting is that he's still, you know, trying to drum up support for some kind of coup that, of course, is not going to happen. But to think that he's stated, you know, publicly that he is fighting the hardest he's ever fought in his life for a job that he has demonstrated and displayed for everyone to see that he has no interest in actually doing is just so bizarre. It's so bizarre. And so you have to wonder, why? Why is he, you know, trying so hard? And we know it's all about the grift. He has millions of dollars, billions probably coming due that he owes who knows who. And every moment he can try and latch on to his supporters and the people who will continue to financially prop him up and send him money for these crazy, you know, going nowhere lawsuits and legal actions. You know, he's going to do it. And even in this signing this bill and really sticking it to Americans by, you know, wasting time, you know, we have to ask the question, how are we not going to get ourselves in this situation again? Because I keep saying it, when the next person like Trump comes along, they will not be so incompetent. They will actually potentially succeed at the terrible things they're trying to do. And so we have to be vigilant, but we also have to lean into who our next president's going to be and put the pressure on that person, starting in about 20-something days. So, you know, I'm just really looking forward to what's to come. But also, you know, I feel like, you know, history repeats. And so we really need to be vigilant about how we make sure that another person, such as Trump, does not become the president in the near future, because we just our democracy will not be able to survive that.
You know, I think you're right. And this calls to mind another possibility through all this, one that I think we have to bear in mind, and that is that it's entirely possible that we may not be rid of Trump, not in the immediate future. He, as you mentioned, has been raising boatloads of money from really gullible people who continue to hand it over to him. And he has made clear his intentions to, first of all, be the de facto Republican nominee in 2024. Secondly, to use his celebrity and his stature and his wealth to set up some sort of media business, some sort of hub, an ideological pole, if you will, in opposition to all of the mainstream media as conservatives conceive of it. And so we may see this situation play out over the next several months or even years, in which Trump continues to be an incredibly vocal presence in American politics. He will continue you know, to tweet from the toilet and beyond, on and on and on again. And it's entirely possible that we may see major figures in Congress wait on Trump's blessing or upon his favor before they go forward, you know, for and against various policy positions. He is still very much in charge of this party, and I think will remain so even after he leaves office. And that's something we have to prepare ourselves for.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the Republicans' work. I don't know why there is so much fealty to this person, who really has done them no favors as well. I mean, he's kind of, you know, the Nero of the Republican Party and has literally burnt it to the ground outside of his own supporters. And so I think there is some reckoning that the Republicans will have to do to decide, do they want the loser of this election to be their party leader? And as I think people come into an awakening in the next, you know, maybe 6 months of this pandemic and what's going to happen going forward, in hindsight, to look back and say, oh my gosh, this is like the worst president in the history of the United States. And we have really hitched ourselves to this, you know, falling star. Like, what are we doing here? I think it might take some time for folks to kind of wake up into that, and I'm hoping that they do. Because, yeah, this doesn't seem like a winning strategy in the long term.
It's been winning for the moneyed class. And why has Trump been so successful? That's a question I think we have to ask ourselves. And it's one that we spent considerable time on this show getting after, and many other members of the pundit industrial complex have spent many, many, many minutes of airtime going after. And I think it's largely because he gave voice to that great untrammeled id in the conservative electorate in the United States. He finally vocalized the racism that had been subsumed in recent decades. He finally vocalized the xenophobia that's always been there, the religious bigotry. He brought that all out front and center, exploiting the opening that was created by the intolerable specter of a black man in the White House. And he has wedged that opening, pried it wide open. So now the party is his party. We've seen Republicans in office who have attempted to enact some sort of principled opposition to him. They have all paid the electoral price for it. Nobody in the party who has dared to stand up for him has a future in politics at the moment. This is where conservative voters are in the United States of America. They are all in for a party that has been entirely captured by and subsumed by Donald Trump. There was a time when you could you credibly look at the conservative electorate in the United States and say that a significant chunk of it was made up of, you know, principled conservatives, people who weren't necessarily, bigots, at least at the surface, people who were interested in things like civil liberties, things like fiscal discipline, and things like property rights, traditional conservative bellwethers. And there was room for reasoned interaction and reasoned opposition with those people. But that is all gone now. That is all gone. This is entirely the party of Trump. So when I say get ready for him to continue to wield considerable influence on American politics, I think that is where we are. We already have leadership and governance such as it is over Twitter. I don't think there's any reason to think that's going to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am hoping that, you know, sort of continues to stop him from spreading disinformation. I mean, I guess he's still spreading it, but at least it feels like every time he tweets something out, you know, that's completely unsubstantiated or false, that they are saying so, which is helpful. But, you know, of course, I think his supporters are so hopped up on the conspiracy theories that it's like, oh yes, he's telling us the truth, and they want to stop him. Who knows? You know, I don't know how this can be sustained without him wielding the kind of power that he has. But you know, it all remains to be seen. I do want to mention one thing, because I told y'all I was going to continue to name names when given the opportunity. There were two people who are Democrats who voted against the $2,000 increased federal stimulus check.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those people was Oregon's own representative from District 5, Kurt Schrader. So please mark that down in your book when we go to vote again. What's interesting is Greg Walden, who is not a favorite of mine, he's outgoing from the Congress and represents a lot of Bend and Central Oregon, a large swath of Oregon that is less populated. He even voted for it. So Kurt Schrader is just one of two House Democrats who voted against the stimulus increase. And I think what's interesting that, of course, people in his district are definitely in need of the additional support. And so I think y'all should start asking your congressman why he voted against this. His district stretches from East Clackamas County to the coast. We know the coast has been hard hit because of the lack of tourism, the lack of ability to host large conferences, which we know for most of us who are in kind of the field where we go to conferences are highlights to our year. But there's been a decrease, of course, in tourism and travel and spending time on the coast as far as the restaurants and industry that really hosts people in the travel world. And so why he would say no to the stimulus is good questions to be asking your rep if Kurt Schrader represents you.
Yeah, something needs to be thrown at him at town hall after town hall. Absolutely. this is Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. What we'd like to hear from you, listeners, on this, our last broadcast of this blighted year, is to hear what you your fondest hopes for the year to come, what you would like to see happen, how you think it might come to pass, and what you would like to see this body politic aim for in the years ahead. Are we extricating ourselves from the era of Trump and this last gasp of white supremacy that we're seeing, or are we in for more of the same? That's what I'm interested in hearing from you. 503-231-8187. I've got a very fond hope for the new year, Tracy.
Yeah, let's hear it.
What I'm hoping is that we'll see some sort of audit of the executive branch of the United States government. And what I mean by this is the president's corruption and that of his supporters and cronies is vast in scope and in scale, both the political corruption and plain old venal personal corruption. It's touched every sinew of this presidential administration. I would remind people that the only reason now we know that the President of the United States used the promise of military aid, or rather the promise to withhold military aid, as a lever over a foreign head of state to exact political dirt on his opponent. The only reason we know about this incident, which, by the way, resulted in the president's impeachment, is because an anonymous CIA operative saw this and decided to blow the whistle. If not for this person, we would have never known about any of this. So this begs a number of questions. It's almost certain that there are levels and levels to the corruption and the grift that this administration has imposed upon the federal government. So we need to turn over all of those rocks. We need to find out where all of this is happening, who's involved. We need to take legal action against people involved if they happen to have broken the law. We need to take plain old ethical action and fire people who may have not broken the law, but who abuse the position for their own gain or for that of the party. We need to do a complete audit of the executive branch. And this is why this is so important. There's a lot of work that we collectively have to do over the next few years, over the next decades in this country. And all of that is going to require strong institutions, and it's going to require trust in those institutions on behalf of the American people. Right now, that trust is not where it needs to be. So I think throwing open the windows, bringing in daylight to the activities of the federal government, particularly the executive branch, is going to go a long way towards rebuilding that trust. And so maybe finally we can get down to the business of confronting this pandemic, addressing environmental degradation, and finally bringing a measure of racial justice to this country. That's what I hope for, Tracy.
I mean, I'm right there with you. I feel like, we are going to be, as you say, turning over these stones for the probably next 30 or 40 years to figure out all the terrible things Donald Trump was doing while, very few people were actually watching, holding those very few people who have known the whole time what he's been doing accountable, if we can. We do know that he's issued 26 pardons in the last week, including, pardons for Roger Stone, Paul Manafort,
Jared's dad.
We could go on and on and on with this, but we know that there are so many crimes here and so many criminals who have been implicated in his crimes that right now, with the pardon, they might not ever be held to account. But we know, you know, where there are crumbs, right? There's a bread trail. There's something else there that we are going to find out. And it does end that kind of looking back at what has all happened. But there needs to be rules. For me, I think one of the first ones is that the presidential pardon should not include being able to pardon anyone who was complicit in crimes that you stated or committed. You know, the pardon in the past has been used to right wrongs of injustice, and right now it's, you know, being used for the purpose of really advancing people who have been quite terrible. We know who have been implicated in crimes related to the president. And so there's a kind of a protection here that's happening because he's really looking into using this as a way to prop up, you know, kind of his own people and pay back people for their loyalty. And we know that there was, you know, of course, in the past, rumblings around him, you know, telling people they'll get a pardon if they just keep quiet. And so this cannot stand, right? There are things like this that don't make any sense that are, you know, even part of the presidential power, because it does create and perpetuate the possibility for impropriety and corruption. Also,
yeah.
You know, you talked about whistleblowers, and, you know, I've thought a long time about why Trump has been able to clean out inspector generals from the different agencies yeah. within the federal government. That should not be possible as well, either. The IG should be protected. There should be no ability for a sitting president to interfere in the responsibility or the work of any inspector general across the federal government, because, of course, that's where the oversight comes, and that's why Trump had no oversight, because he was able to, with a written document, get rid of the people who were providing the oversight. That doesn't make sense. And as I say, you know, we need to prepare our democracy for another Trump who will be way more competent. We need to put the rules in place. And this is what I totally agree with what you're saying, Abe. A true span of everything, but also as we see, you know, these things come to light, because everything will come to light at one point about what Trump has been doing, that we begin to put some parameters and some bumpers on the presidential power. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. To give just one example of what you're talking about with regard to inspectors general, if people will recall back in the spring when Congress passed the first round of COVID relief, there was a $500 billion slush fund designated to aid struggling corporations, the disbursement of which was placed at the discretion of the executive branch. One of the first things that Trump did after that legislation was passed is he fired the inspector general that would oversee the disbursement of $500 billion. And even today, we don't know where most of that money has gone. These people are robbing the place in the light of day, and they're doing it because they know they will face no consequences. And really, that, when I was talking about auditing the executive branch and bringing some accountability back to government, that's what people need to know. That's what they need to realize, so that they can begin to restore their trust in government institutions. Is that if somebody abuses the public trust, they will face consequences. At minimum, they will never hold the public trust again. That's the sort of thing we need to see. 503. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. You're listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7. Go ahead and say what you're going to say, Tracy, and then we'll go to the phones.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we also have to be thinking about every Senate Republican who has been enabling this abuse as well, right? There's been an abuse of power, and the Senate Republicans have literally sat by and aided and abetted in that. And so I do want to, you know, also put some spotlight on those people who literally have kind of turned their back on the democracy for the sake of being a sycophant for this one strong man person who's really just cornered all there.
I totally agree. Let's go to Francis. Good morning, Francis.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
I agree that part of one thing that Trump has done is expose the corruption as he follows. It's almost like he's following a script. He's truly exposed the corruption in our government, and the Republican majorities own corruption. The ability for him to continue, his only way he's able to continue doing what he says, they're allowing him to. Mm-hmm. But as far as the future goes, I would very much, of course, like to see some kind of relief from this COVID pandemic. But also, I would love to see the two Senate Democrat senators in Georgia win.
Yes.
So that our Senate will be able to possibly pursue some of the transformative things that I hope the new administration is going to introduce. One of the things that I really would like to see happen is that the bill that one of my political heroes is Congresswoman Barbara Lee from Oakland, California. And she proposed last summer, or introduced some legislation that would establish a National Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would actually look at the racial disparities and acknowledge them in our country and begin some sort of reconciliation for the years of continued oppression. And that, to me, would be the ideal thing to happen in our new government. I hope that that is still on the table and will be considered. I think that is probably the only way that we're ever going to get past any of this, is to actually have a commission that acknowledges and admits all of the injustice that has occurred in our country and continues to happen today. So that's my wish for the future. And I hope it happens.
Well, thank you, Francis.
You guys take care.
Appreciate the call. And we always appreciate your calls, Francis. I'm really glad you're a part of the dialogue on this show. Thank you.
You guys take care.
Thank you.
You do the same.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is a big one. I think this country could use something like a South Africa-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But the long-term goal of, you know, establishing true equity in this country, and maybe with a shorter-term goal of actually prying open the eyes of white people who really refuse to acknowledge what has actually transpired in this country over the centuries and what continues to happen every day. That's desperately needed.
Well, I think it would begin with an overhaul of our education system, because our education system perpetuates myths and lies about history, about the impact of racism on First Peoples, on, you know, descendants of enslaved Africans. It continues to perpetuate the reasons why people, specifically white people, believe that all good contributions to this country have come from white people. And so it has to start there, in that truth space, for sure. But it also has to start thinking about what is equity versus equality. And I think in our country, we focus on equality a lot. And we don't even really have a good understanding collectively of what equity means. Equity is not giving everyone the same thing, whether that's a $600 stimulus check, a $2,000 stimulus check. It takes more time. It requires us to look at the historical underpinnings of a person's life, their story, their history, their culture, and how that has been impacted by American culture, and begin to give people what they need individually or at the community level And what's interesting is when we've tried to do things that look like equity, even in the state of Oregon, so the state of Oregon came together and wanted to do something for Black communities and put together a fund for Black communities. And as soon as that fund started to be distributed, white people in the state of Oregon, loggers, others, started to file petitions to have that not happen. That it was harming them to not be able to get a part of that because they were not Black-owned businesses. This is where we go all the way wrong, thinking that somehow by giving everyone the same thing, we're eventually going to be equal. No, it perpetuates inequality, because if people who already had what they needed to run their businesses get the same thing as people who are struggling, we're going to continue to just be unequal. And so equity is about giving people opportunity, resources that have been, because of inequality and because of discrimination, have been stifled for those folks. And so I think we have to, yes, absolutely, what Francis is saying, come together and really have some reconciliation. But we have to have some collaborative understanding and discussion about what does it mean to be an equitable society as opposed to an equal society.
So what's the rebuttal? So let's say I'm a I'm a white man. Let's say I own a small business and I'm upset because, you know, I'm struggling. I've got a small company just getting going, but the guy down the street is getting some money from the federal government because he happens to be a Black man. I want some of that money too. What is the rebuttal?
The rebuttal is that there's all kinds of ways that white businesses are able to get funds. They're oftentimes more likely to get funding from banks, traditional banks, whereas because lenders are not so friendly with Black people and Black businesses, there's just not a relationship there oftentimes. And so I understand what you're saying. I can definitely agree that for some people it feels like a slight. However, if we're ever going to get to equity, there has to be an understanding that this is making up for years of not being able to get any resources, of struggling. And yes, we're all struggling in this moment, and I think it's a time for us to come together and not use things like resources as wedge issues to turn away from each other. And there are other ways in which we can see ourselves as part of the solution as opposed to creating more problems. So that
now,
fund that we're talking about is on pause currently.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that reform of the education system, fundamental reform of the educational system, was key to addressing some of the other issues we were talking about. It seems to me that this is yet another arena in which fundamental education reform will pay long-term dividends. That I know we're diverging a little bit here, but yeah, I think these are important questions. So in this concept of an equitable nation that we're talking about, how does reforming the way we educate the public, how does that fit into your overall conception of equity?
Well, like I said, if you are raising children from a very young age to think that, you know, Thanksgiving is a celebratory moment and that, you know, Native peoples and white folks came together and had a peaceful meal every year since, you know, 1620, you are perpetuating a myth that is damaging. It's damaging to descendants of First People here in America today. We know that they are underrepresented in probably every sector of American society that leans into, you know, being successful, living out the American dream. And so we know that there's something there, right? And if we continue to tell that narrative that, you know, slavery or enslaving others was for their own benefit, it wasn't that bad, you know, however we try and gloss over it, and I am a product of public education, not, you know, dissing public education, but there are some myths there that are problematic for even having a reconciliation and knowing what the truth is. We try and so many ways try and make ourselves as a country feel better about our history, because it feels bad, and we begin to feel guilty, we begin to feel shame and blame and fearful for even having this conversation, and we sit in a space of denial more than anything else about the real and true history of this country. And, you know, our callers are very aware. They call us all the time and tell us, you know, that the whole system is founded on, you know, oppression and, you know, support for white land-owning people. But if you are not able to see that, you will not be able to see the truth that flows from that. And so we have to have a reboot on history education. I could just tell you in my public education experience, you know, the conversation about Native peoples was probably a day long. The conversation about the enslavement of Africans was probably about 30 minutes long. And so it really gets glazed over and glossed over, that we are not able to see that it is part of every fabric of the American experience. And so as long as we are doing that, we are replicating ideologies around white supremacy and denial of the actual experiences of those people who were first here, of the originally enslaved Africans and their descendants and the lived experiences that we have today.
That's outstanding. You touched on something there that I think is key to this whole thing, and that is you talked about, you know, the emotional response, the feeling that many white people have when they, you know, when they open their eyes and they try to come to grips with this history, is that it makes them feel bad, it makes them feel guilty, they don't like thinking about their country and by extension themselves in that light, and so they either reject it or they shy away from it and they don't give it the diligence that it needs. This is something we need to encourage people to push past. In my personal experience, you know, yes, I felt some of those things when I started grappling with some of these issues in a really deep way. You know, the pain of it, the shame of it, the overwhelmingness of it, the feeling like, how can we ever redress these things? But if you push past those feelings and you really start to get into the fine grain of the history, it's a liberating and empowering thing. It's as if you could finally see what needs to be done and finally see where we need to go. And then you realize as a white person that, yes, while you bear a share of responsibility for how the world is and how you move through it and how your privilege affects that, you do not share in the guilt of, you know, enslaving Africans or of stealing the nation from Native Americans. You share in the responsibility of how things are and then the responsibility of the need to change them. But it's liberating. You don't have to, you know, accepting these things does not mean you live a life of guilt as a white person. It means you live a life of open-eyed clarity. That's what it means. So maybe in the new year, if you're a white person and you've got members of your family or of your circle of friends who are having trouble coming to grips with the state of racial justice in this country, help them to push past those feelings of shame and of guilt and of fear, because there's something more enlightening on the other side of that. It's true. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is Two Lunch Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Abe Proctor. Sitting across the digital gap from me is Tracy Simmons, and we are asking you, our listeners, to share with us your hopes for the coming year. Tracy, what are you really hoping to see? What else are you hoping to see this year?
You know, I'm definitely in that space of just hoping we can continue distributing this vaccine in an equitable manner. I hear that in Oregon, we are getting vaccinations out to older folks convalescent type homes. I don't have the great word in my head right now, but we're getting that out to older folks who are in group home settings. So that's fantastic. I think we absolutely need to figure out how to vaccinate our Oregon houseless folks. I'm really hoping that we will continue in this new Congress, and hopefully we can get the Georgia seats secured, but be able to really do some phenomenal work as far as the legislation that I feel like we haven't done any for a long time, as long as Mitch McConnell has been in that leadership role as a majority leader. We have seen a lot of great work go nowhere, and so I'm really hoping that we can move that. I think that would be phenomenal for our country. I really hope that Joe Biden will lean into his presidency with vim and vigor. What I feel like is being signaled right now is that, oh, I can't do that, I can't do that, and can't never did do nothing. And so I'm a little nervous about that. But we're going to push on that. I'm really hopeful as well that this economy can shift in a way that is more equitable. If we continue on the path that we're on, where billionaires and millionaires continue to reap the benefits of the work of average, regular working Americans, and everyone is really struggling, I see no other alternative but for a huge anti-capitalist revolution. I'm hoping that we can right-size it. And, you know, I was watching some TV the other day, and Robert Reich, who you've talked about before, yeah, former labor secretary, has a film, it's a few years old at this point, but a film on saving capitalism. And I am not a big fan of capitalism in the form that we are currently in, but I don't think capitalism is the devil. I think it's the way that we have structured our capitalist society to be very inequitable, and it could be right-sized and changed. And so he gives some opportunities for really looking at that, looking at things like the gap in pay between executives and kind of entry-level mm-hmm. workers, looking at things like tax reform and how the tax code is literally written for people who have lots and lots of money and want to write off on you know their yacht or get a write-off for their free martini lunch. But really looking at the structures in a way that gives us clear eyes about what could be done to make it a more equitable society. And so, I mean, I lean into that. I don't think it's going to happen in 2021 necessarily, but I think this work that we can really begin with the new leadership and a resolve as a country to get through this pandemic together.
Tracy, my yacht costs a lot, all right? And, you know, maybe you're not a yacht owner, but you just don't know, okay? I mean, first you got to find a place to keep it. You know, you need one big enough to land a helicopter on. And these things don't come cheap. You know, I need a little back. I need a little back from Uncle Sam for that.
I mean, it's just, it's gross. I mean, really, if you look at our tax code, and I know you don't have a yacht because I would have gone on it by now.
That's where I'm broadcasting from right now.
But yeah, no, it's really gross when you look deeply into the tax code and the ways in which people can write off things. You know, we know that it is just a way that continues to perpetuate inequality and inequity. And so, yeah, there's work that needs to be done. We know that Trump did, as his first grand act as president, really did what he calls, quote-unquote, tax reform. And what we'll see in the next couple of years is that regular people, taxpaying, hardworking Americans, are going to get shafted, as it were, in the tax, because it's changing year after year. And so hopefully that will be a signal for Americans to start pushing back on these just crazy tax codes, the ways in which very rich people can write off pretty much anything and everything, and the rest of us literally never even see our money. It gets to us after it's been basically garnished by the federal government to continue propping up social programs that everyone benefits from, that rich people likely and, you know, more often than not don't even pay into, and corporations as well. So there's a lot there that we could be doing and really, you know, using an equity lens to assess what is happening and why we, you know, are having to give $2,000 stimulus checks to people when we've seen our billionaires, you know, increase their wealth in the billions just in the last, you know, 10 months.
Yeah, I think you're spot on about that. because, you know, you think of all the ways in which we as a nation are able to incentivize different kinds of behavior. The tax code is one of the most effective levers for that, right? Because, you know, people like their money. They like to keep on hold of their money, and they like to know that their money, if they have to pay taxes, is doing something useful. So, you know, the way we incentivize or disincentivize through the tax code is huge. It can affect everything from environmental policy and behavior, you know, to social environmental justice issues, to labor issues, and on and on and on. There was a book that came out several years ago by the great French economist Thomas Piketty called Capitalism, in which he boiled down the current state of things, essentially, to one equation, which was this. R is greater than G. What that means is that the return on investment for private capital, meaning what a rich person can earn if they buy stocks, if they buy bonds, if they buy real estate, futures, or what have you, the rate of return on that stuff, on capital investment, is greater than the rate of growth for the overall economy. So what does that mean? That means if you're a wealthy capitalist, there's literally no incentive beyond your own private morality or sense of ethics. There's no incentive for you to invest in things that bring about greater economic gains for the larger body politic. Why do that when you can park your money in some investment that gives you a greater return on investment? So through the tax code, we have a tool to reverse that, to disincentivize it. And here's what I mean. If you look back at what we have come to call the post-war liberal consensus, which governed American spending policy, really starting in the Depression before the war, we had a set of policies that incentivized the right sorts of things for working people in the United States. Now, there are a bunch of very serious racial issues that overlay what I'm talking about, but the broader truth of what I'm saying in terms of taxation and spending policy is true. We were able to answer the question during that post-war period that right now you can't even bring up in polite political society, which is, how much is enough? How much money should any one person be allowed to accumulate before the government starts taxing that at an incredibly high rate? And during the post-war liberal consensus, we came to an agreement about that. So people in the very highest margins of the income tax scale were paying in excess of 90%, right? So this doesn't mean that you're paying 90% on your first 50 grand or whatever. It means you're paying 90% on your 15th million and your 16th million and so on and so forth. Rich people were still able to be rich and get richer. Working people were able to earn a wage that allowed them to sustain a decent standard of living. We invested in a university system that became the envy of the world. We built an interstate highway system. We rebuilt our defeated enemies, we founded a space program, and we helped establish an international political order which, despite its many flaws, has managed to prevent a large-scale conflict between major geopolitical powers for nearly a century. We did all of this voluntarily, and the levers we moved were largely that of the income taxation system. So this can be done. This can be done. And I'm really glad you mentioned that, Tracy, because that's maybe my deepest and most cherished wish for the new year that, of course, has absolutely no chance of coming to pass. Yeah. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. There's another thing I'm wishing for the new year.
And that is
I would like to see throughout the Democratic Party, every single candidate for public office renounce corporate financial contributions and contributions from political action committees. This last electoral cycle, there was a record 155 incumbents and challengers who vowed to reject corporate PAC money during the 2020 campaign. That's according to an organization called End Citizens United. We have many high-profile politicians have shown that this model gets them elected. AOC is a good example. Bernie Sanders, although he didn't manage to win the presidency, doesn't take any corporate PAC money when he runs for the Senate. It can be done. It can be done. And if we're talking about removing the influence of big money on our political system, then we need to remove the influence of big money on political candidates. And if we have more and more politicians model this, who show that they can win office simply by taking the donations of individual citizens, that's how we do it. So I'm hoping for the next electoral cycle in 2022 that we can get every Democratic candidate to renounce corporate money and PAC contributions. Also, probably not going to happen, but there you have it.
Planting seeds. You know what I would like to do, and you know, I know we've talked about this at a very short period of time, but ranked choice voting as well. Where we have an opportunity to bring in other political parties. We know the two-party system does not work. The stronghold that the two parties have on our kind of even conception of a democracy is troubling and challenging. And it doesn't allow for new thought. It's very much status quo. And we've had a two-party system for way too long. Third parties don't get opportunities to even emerge in this current structure that we have. And it is a stifle on progressive thought, progressive action, and, you know, progressive legislation. That is my opinion. And I know that in places where ranked choice voting has been enacted, it's a little harder to, you know, on election night determine who won. But it is a step in the right direction for having a new political party emerge and really bring us into the progressive future that we seek. And so that's just, you know, an idea I think could actually move somewhere in the state of Oregon. Alaska has employed ranked choice voting very recently. We've seen it in other countries where it works well, where there are, you know, there's not a two-party hold on the system, and new parties can emerge, and some of them are, you know, the party of Cookie Monster. You know, it could be hinky, it could be weird, but also it can allow for innovative ideologies around how to lead a country of this size and how to lead a country towards greater equity. And so something that I've been thinking about for a while as well. And of course, getting rid of Citizens United. How do we get rid of that? Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, be hard to see the current court overturning that decision.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. let's go to the phones. Pear, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to see a cut in the military budget.
Oh yeah,
that was about $750 billion. If you add in all the extras, it's getting up to $1 trillion. And I would like to see some of the bases shut down, some of the troops come home. I mean, it's ridiculous. We're spending ourselves into kind of oblivion. All the things we could do with that money here at home, you know, and all the extra surplus military hardware goes to our police, and they use it here at home. So that's what I would like to see. But I'm not too optimistic about it, though.
No, in fact, we just saw Congress vote to override Trump's veto of the most recent military spending bill.
You know, and then I don't know. I think some of the Democrats have got a fixation on Russia for some reason, and so I'm a little leery about that. So, but that's my fond hope.
Yeah, I share that hope, Pear. Hey, listen, thank you for the call, and have a happy new year.
Happy new year.
Yeah, right? That's the big sacred cow that neither of the major two parties seems really willing to deal with, the military budget. Absolutely and incredibly bloated beyond all recognition. We spend more on our military budget than the next five nations combined, and four of those are our allies. It's staggering and it's monstrous. And it's sucking the future of the nation right down its pipes. Pear is absolutely correct. I don't hold out a lot of hope for that one, though. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You're listening to Too Much Information. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. There's one thing that we haven't mentioned today, and that is, if you haven't already, become a member of KBOO. Support this station, support this program, and the other great programming that you hear every minute of every day on this station. You can do that by visiting kboo.fm, clicking on the donate button. And while you're there, have a look around. Virtually every episode of every show that airs on this station is available as a podcast for your listening pleasure later on. So have a look around. You know, support your local community radio station here in the coming year. Well, Tracy, what's on your mind here as we close out 2020?
You know, I am, like I said, just really trying to lean into this non-party. I'm not going to be going to any parties or doing anything super exciting. But I did do one thing for myself, for my own presence. I got myself a new meditation bell. And so I am really trying to hold myself accountable to doing a morning meditation and setting intentions for my day every day in 2021. It's been so helpful in 2020 where, you know, days I woke up tired. Some days I woke up feeling traumatized from whatever happened the day previous. And other days I just woke up angry, just literally pissed off at the world, pissed off at Trump, angry at the Republicans, angry at the Democrats, frustrated at everything. And I'm really trying to enter into 2021 with clear eyes, of course, seeing that nothing is going to ever be perfect, yet setting my own intentions for how I'm going to move through each day. And I'm encouraging other folks to do that. The other thing that I really want to encourage folks to do, and I will be doing myself, is in spite of who knows what's going to happen with a $2,000 stimulus. We know that's not going to be enough for some. We know some won't need it. But if you are a person who gets something and doesn't need it, please consider donating that money to a mutual aid fund, your local food pantry, your local food bank, whoever you think needs that funding. And even if it's an individual that you know, please consider donating that if it's something that you don't personally need. And so I don't anticipate getting much of anything, but I don't need it and I'm going to give it away. So that is how I'm moving into the 2021 year. I'm wishing all of our listeners an amazing new year. And thank you so much, Abe, for the opportunity to have this platform. And so I'll turn it back over to you, Abe. What are your last thoughts?
Well, I'm going to use my $2,000 stimulus to get another flat screen TV for the yacht. So I don't know what you're doing. what you mentioned about, taking the first part of the day to set your intentions and clear your mind for the day ahead, I think that's really useful advice. And Susan writes into the show, Tracy, with some words that might offer you some inspiration. She writes, "Tracy, as a longtime listener, you are a stellar, thoughtful addition to the program. KBOO was wise to have selected you. Keep up the good work, both of you, and have a happy new year." Thank you for that, Susan. Yeah, I think I have to say I've never really felt this particular way at the close of any year in my life. I don't think any of us have ever lived through a year like this in our lives. It's difficult to sift through the sheer mass of everything that has happened. Let's not forget that we began this year with an impeached president, and we continued into a once in 100 years global public health event, and we lived through the west coast of North America burning for yet another year, and on and on and on and on. At some point, it becomes almost too much to process. So what I'm hoping for myself and for everybody who's listening is maybe they take your advice, Tracy. They look for ways to simplify. They look for ways to clear their minds and make each day intentional and purposeful. And that perhaps collectively that will help us all to nudge each other towards where we need to be. Slow down is my advice to people in the new year. Be intentional, be deliberate, be thoughtful about everything that you do. Pay attention. That's what I'm saying. All right, I guess that brings us to the end of today's program. Anything you want to say to send us off, Tracy?
No, just, you know, be safe, mask up. If you do decide to go out, do something, do it outside. It's going to be cold as heck and likely rainy.
But, you know, be safe. Please do not, you know, spread COVID. We will have another new year, hopefully, if we can get through this one. And so, you know, if you choose to drink, don't drive. If you choose to gather with other folks, please wear a mask, social distance, take care of yourself and others. That's all.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody out there, for your support of this program. Have a wonderful and safe new year, and we will be back at you in January. Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is Alternative Radio, followed by Flashpoints at 10 a.m. KBOO is working our way towards our end of the year goal on Give Guide, so